I've been told that the sound is it really drops off in the back of the room so that I can actually speak up and it will work fine. That's better. Okay. I was asked what the title of the talk might be because they record these things, and I said I will say after we'll see what talk comes out and then we'll name it. Because I have all these papers, it seems like I'm doing every Dharma talk I've ever done all in one talk. So we'll either have to talk really fast or cut some things out. A couple months ago, I had an accident which was serious and kind of a near-death experience where I crashed on my bike instantly. I don't even remember it, don't know what happened. And landed on my eye, and then in my shoulder, and kind of had a Van Gogh ear it was hanging off. They did a great job on all the stitching. But I was knocked out and came to on the side of the road a few minutes later. They said I'd been staring at the sky for a while. And this moment of waking up really impressed me, and it seems like there was a lot in there. I learned a lot in there. I'll say more about that later. When I woke up, I was blind in the left eye for a little while. And I'm still feeling kind of shaky. The body's kind of shaky, feeling kind of vulnerable from the accident. So it's interesting to watch, to be mindful, watch the body, watch the mind sort of figure itself back out, come back into the world. So I'll start with the theme. We're part of a big experiment here in what is Buddhist practice going to look like in this millennium. And there's all kinds of voices for that. And one of the current voices that's in vogue is mindfulness and science, doing a lot of studies, bringing together psychological work and mindfulness practice. And this is all great stuff. A good friend of mine, he's devoting his life to that. How can we translate Buddhist practice into a language that's accessible to Western society? And this is part of the mainstreaming of the Dharma, which is excellent work. It makes it accessible to many people. I teach at the Berkeley YMCA, a meditation class and a yoga class, and they have a program here with the high school where they get their PE credits by coming to class. So I have these 15-year-olds coming to yoga and meditation. So speaking in a language that they can understand, and just seeing them there at 16 meditating and doing yoga is pretty impressive. So this mindfulness in the schools where we figure out how to speak in different ways. I mean, they say the Buddha did that. He could give the same talk at the same time to all different levels of people. So this is one voice, the scientific voice, but I'm not that up on it. I'm not that interested in it. I want to give a counter voice to that. I have a background in art, painting minimalist blue abstract paintings for 30 years. And even back then in the 80s, we would be painting little blue square, big blue squares, and we were audacious enough to say we were painting direct experience. So it was about perception and experience and coming from the side of humanities rather than the side of science. So the science voice is great. It does have some dangers or traps. If we try to measure everything and make everything uniform and make and generalize, we might get a little too reductionist with it. I think that I like to bring in the poetic and the artistic voice to these things, that Dharma is something where we can bring our own quirky characters, our own natures to the practice. So we have to be careful how we approach science, there's even a way that when we institutionalize anything, we can reduce it and lose some of the juice. Quote here somewhere. The philosopher Richard Rorty says, what counts as an accurate report of experience is a matter of what a community will let you get away with. So there's ways in which, without even knowing it, we are setting up the discourse in this room. I talk a certain way, I use a certain Vipassana voice. I don't come in here, I gave a talk to a bunch of artists a while back. And in there, if I tell stories about being crazy and drunk and weird or something, it probably means I'm a great talker and I get points for that. But that kind of discourse wouldn't work in here. When I do a day long, I try to keep that in mind, keep it open. I imagine one of the weirdest guys I can imagine, Charles Bukowski. And I say, what if Bukowski came into this day long? Could we accommodate it? Could we listen to the voice? There's a philosopher, Zizek, who I saw a while back, and I was 3 feet from him, and he's spitting and spewing, and he's a genius. But if he walked in here, we would be like, call the cops on this guy. So we've got to be careful of, you know, coming up with an image of what Dharma practice is, and then we're reducing ourselves and imitating each other, and we could lose something there. So what is Dharma practice about? We talked during the practice period, we did a little bit of labeling, and I was speaking about that as a practice of knowing what's going on. So this word knowing, what does it mean? It's interesting to think in our culture, we use the word knowing a lot, and then a teacher like Achan Cha says, who is the knower? What is it that's known here? And that's two very different senses of the word. When we use it in our culture, often there's a subject, me, who knows, there's an object, it's absolutist, it's the truth, I think I know, and then I think I'm right, and then I go around telling other people they're wrong. It's sad when this starts to happen in the Buddhist world, which it's just human nature. We bring our habits into the scene. But sometimes you'll see Zen people going, well, we're the right way, and Theravada, we're the right way, because we have the true texts of the Buddha. Often if I see a Christian do that, I say, well, you're being fundamentalist with the Bible. But it's funny how we can do that with our own text and say, no, it says it right here in the text. So we know the true thing that Buddha was saying. Rather than having a chorus of different voices, different teachers that we can draw from. I think at Spirit Rock, they're pretty good at doing that on the West Coast here, inviting a whole range of teachers. So you sit down on the cushion, you say, what is this? You breathe in and out, you look deeply, what is this here? This is the kind of knowing we're talking about. You start to learn inside your own body, inside your own mind, what is going on here? Directly, without beneath the words. Very informative that the self you thought you had starts to fall apart. The first time you sit down, all the chattering is going on and you realize, wow, I thought I was in charge here, but I guess not. I like that in Zen they talk often about not knowing, just as a counter voice to that knowing. But actually to sit there with a sense of not, I don't know what's happening. I woke up from falling on my head. I didn't know what was happening. Came to like, whoa. And I was coming alive right in that moment. It was really felt like I was experiencing the wheel of dependent origination, there was something bubbling up that wanted to wake up. Just for a second, I struggled to come to after I'd blacked out. And then the world started to come alive around me, and even the vision started to come back in the left eye. So in our culture, we have ideas of knowing that go all the way back to the Greek, and there's a lot of dualisms in it, and which is what I gave a talk on here once. I am definitely not going to have time for all those quotes. But in there are a lot of assumptions about language, about view. Talk about right view in Buddhism. We sit on the cushion, and then we start speaking, And the minute I start speaking, all these assumptions are in the speaking. I think we need to have more ways to look at that here, because often we sit, and that's our practice. So to have conversations, to have Dharma talks, discussions, to examine our assumptions that we're even bringing into the Buddhist practice. Assumptions about our experience, assumptions about our minds, assumptions about the truth. Thich Nhat Hanh says, as far as right view, which is interesting to take that apart. And one way to take it apart is this word right. It's a little, we could have better translations, maybe our best view, our peak view. It's related to a mountain peak, Sama. Or Achan Amaro talks about it as attuned view. So it's not so much right view, like we're right and those guys are wrong. It's what is our best view? What's the clear view? And the clear view is impermanence. So in this way, Thich Nhat Hanh says all views are wrong views, because any view you can put into a sentence, anything you can pare down to a few words, is not going to cover the whole universe. So our view is always opening, and it's always right here. What is this? What's the view here? Right here from this spot where you're sitting or standing. So there's a fluidity in it, an openness in it, a movement. It doesn't get rigid or absolute. Achan Amaro talks about the Buddha painting the Dharma in broad strokes. And then we fill it in. We have to fill it in with our own experience. We have to try it out, fit into it. This is why it's good to work with a teacher. Achan Cha's famous saying where he said, he just stands behind you going, a little to the left, a little to the right, as you're wandering forward on your path, having these guides that have gone before us. But it's very much depends on our position in that moment, in time, in a culture, in our lives. So it's dangerous to universalize and have a one-size-fits-all absolutist kind of practice. The psychologist Adam Phillips says, theories are more like songs than instructions. Can we listen to the teachings, take them in, digest them in a way that moves in tune with our soulfulness, our character? Philosopher Richard Rorty again said, the world does not split itself up on its own into sentence-shaped chunks called facts. How often do we say something? We think we're reporting on the world, that we're reporting on those facts or those details, without seeing that we're actually doing that with our mind and our language. We're selecting, we're editing, picking out, we're shaping. And that somebody else might have, from the other side, might have a different view of this stuff. Rorty again, we hope to replace the reality appearance distinction with this distinction more useful and less useful. This is exactly like skillful means in Buddhism. That's why I love, that's my favorite theme. What do we need? What is the practice now for this person in this moment? It might look the very opposite of what somebody else needs in that moment. So opening up the conversation to a variety of voices. This is why some of you know my friend and teacher, Claude Anshin Thomas, very different voice, who was here. He was here actually when I had this accident. So he was here for 2 weeks in December. Has anybody here ever seen Claude Anshin Thomas? You have, John. So most of you haven't. He's a Zen teacher who is American. He was shot down 4 or 5 times in Vietnam, and he's been through it. He was came home from Vietnam, trauma, crime, drugs, until he met Thich Nhat Hanh, and it turned him around. A lot of trauma, a lot of post-traumatic stuff. He He went to visit Thich Nhat Hanh. This is 91, not that long ago. Stayed in a tent in the woods with a tripwire around it that he put up in case they were going to kill him because they were Vietnamese. He wasn't sure yet what was going on. He would pick up a cereal box in the market and not know if it was booby-trapped. Talked to Thich Nhat Hanh every day. Thich Nhat Hanh was more kind and open with him and welcoming than anybody he had met since the Vietnam War. Turned him around, he became a Zen monk. He spends most of his time wandering around the world. He's more known in Europe than here. He does pilgrimages. He was ordained in Auschwitz and walked to Vietnam. He walked across this country from New York to Albany right out here a few years back. So when he comes out here, I organize the events for him. He went in and worked with some gangs in Richmond. Good stuff. He's able to talk to people that don't usually have access to that. He's got all the tattoos and all that. They're under his robes. But somehow the street comes through. He can walk up to people anywhere. When I walk into certain group, Amaro told me in a certain group that I was subbing at, I look like well-meaning white boy there. It's a group for drug offenders. When Claude walked in, before he even said a word, they were all walking, streaming up to him going, hey, bro, this, that, high five. He could feel it. I was at retreats in Europe where somebody raised their hand and said, I was an assassin for the Red Brigades, but I want to turn it around now. I want to turn around the violence. So Claude teaches about violence. Teaches, and the way he starts teaching about violence is here, right here. It's not out there, it's here. What is the violence? What is the anger in my own heart? We sometimes don't want to hear it. He's a tough teacher. He was, the first day I met him in Switzerland when I lived there, walking down the river, I was complaining about how uptight the Swiss were and how it was so too clean, too rich. And he just stopped me in my tracks right by the river and said, yeah, but you could help them out. It was a Zen arrow. This was 1996, the day I met him. Something of that arrow is in this talk right here. It motivated me forward. So when he was in this group a decade or so ago, was anybody here then? Joyce? Controversial. Good stuff. A counter voice. He came in, he gave a brilliant talk. His talk used to start in the 90s. He'd hold up his hand and say, with this finger, I killed 180 people before I was 18. And he put his hand down. He had your attention at that point. I first heard that at a yoga center in Switzerland. So he came in here and he gave a great talk. And I was sitting right there because I had introduced him, and there was a fellow sitting next to me who was trembling after the talk. And he said, he raised his hand, he said, Claude, you just blew me away. I don't know, you just showed me all about my mind, all about the anger in there, when I thought I was so righteous, but some of my own stuff. And he said, I'm actually shaky about this. I don't know what to do. This was right here. And so Claude was in my position. He looked to him and spoke to him at the same time teaching the whole group. And Claude said, told a story, he said, and I'll speak in the eye as Claude. He said, when I got kicked out of my apartment a little while ago, they didn't kick me out when I was a drug dealer and a criminal, but now they kicked me out. And when they kicked me out, I wanted to go buy a gun and shoot the landlord, his wife, and the little baby. He said that sentence right here. And you could feel the room just go, was blown back. And then he continued, he said, and then I had the thought, I won't buy a gun, I'll just blow up the house. And then I had the thought, no, I'll just make a bomb and blow up the car. And then he said, I'll just put sugar in the gas tank. He's already teaching right there. And he said, people come up to him, they go, Claude, you're a monk, how can you have such evil thoughts? And he said, it's because I'm a monk, I know I'm having these thoughts. We all have these thoughts. If you've ever been on retreat, we all have every kind of thought. How many people in here have been on a 10-day retreat or more? Okay, we all have those thoughts. So after Claude did this, it blew people back. Either they loved him or they hate him at that point. But then we had the question and answer period, and someone raised their hand and they said, "Hey, Claude, wow, that was pretty impressive. And you know, last week I was at the dentist, and he was drilling in there, and I wanted to kill him." I've never heard anybody bring up a comment like that in a room like this, in this kind of space. So Claude opens up the space for discourse. It can be tough medicine when he comes at you, but it's the truth. He's looking for the truth of our own experience and looking at our own violence as the roots of violence. He says somebody asked him once, what should peace activists do, anti-war activists? And he said, well, they should take basic training. Why? Because then they know what it's like to go through a soldier. He was to be a soldier. He was talking about the Occupy, the Sacramento, where the cops pepper sprayed the students who were just sitting there. And which was, you know, a nightmare. But Claude said, well, do you happen to know that that cop was a veteran, was a soldier? What has that person been through that created the conditions for them to act that way to the students? So do we polarize in our own peace-loving kind of activity? We have a peace vigil that I started after 9/11 every Friday on campus on Oxford Street there on the grass. 12 to 1 every Friday. We've been there over 10 years. Every time Claude's here, he sits with us. First time he came there, a couple years after 9/11, he turned to me afterward and he said, wow, there's a lot of violence here. You could feel people around. And there was one guy had threatened my life for sitting there. We get projected on all the time. Very interesting practice as far as engaging this practice. How do we take this sense of knowing, asking what's this, this breath, this phenomena, this arising? How do we move it out into the world? Sitting at the peace vigil, people walk up, they ask questions, they project all over us. One guy walked up a few weeks ago, he's like, yeah, sit there like that, that'll really do it, and walked away. As if that's all we do. See, he's freezing the people. Well, yeah, we sit there Friday from 12 to 1. A couple of people sitting that day are very active in the world, extremely active all over the place. But this person had thrown their own image on us of what we were doing there. So Claude bringing, opening up the space, opening the voice, a different voice. I fell on my head and he visited me every day after that. Very busy schedule, but he would come by the house and visit while I was healing, and he told me, you're going to be careful, you're going to have some funny brain activity. They didn't tell me, good thing he told me, they didn't tell me this at the hospital. And the next day I was trying to tell somebody where I live, and I said, I live on Vine Street and, you know, that street right there, Vine, and I couldn't even remember my own street. Stephen Batchelor talks about being a monk decades ago and doing deep retreat practice and the veils dropping away. What is this? Knowing. Veils dropping away. And there's this sense where you wake up. Wow. Just that we're here. The mystery of it, just that we're alive. You get that on retreat. It was kind of like that after the bike accident. I woke up and I went, oh, I'm alive, because I didn't have to wake up. I could have just gone, went the other way and I would be dead. This is there in practice too, every moment, every breath. We're here now, we're awake now, wow. Temple Smith, another teacher, local teacher, speaking here, was talking about sitting on retreat with his father on a 12-day retreat and looking over at his father in the middle of the retreat and going, who is that guy? I don't know who he is. I thought I'd been throwing images on him my whole life. and realizing, I don't even know anything about this guy. And he said it opened up a space where he could then ask many questions to his father. Who are you? What is your life about? What was your childhood about? So letting these assumptions that we think we know drop away, drop away, drop away. So some of these things we could call our shadow stuff, things we've hidden. It's pretty easy. You can hide anywhere. You can hide in spiritual practice. Hide your emotions, spiritual bypassing. Hide your stuff in your body. This is why coming to the body, coming to the breath, right here in the body. The body doesn't lie about this stuff. So investigating these parts, these habits. I saw also when I woke up out of the bike accident, the habit mind. Boy, I've had cancer 17 years. This all started in Switzerland, actually, about that time when I met Claude. They couldn't figure out exactly what it was for 8 years, which I liked. It was kind of Buddhist. And I'd rather had it be that than, oh, you have this tumor and it looks like this. It was an unknown, misty kind of cancer. Although they did say it's going to explode at any moment, with a German accent, in 1996. That wasn't a helpful story. It never did explode like that. It was the story. They thought they knew. I was sitting with doctors at one point, because I have had this so long that I know as much about my cases more than some of them. And they had a theory about a certain cause and effect lineage there. And I said, no, it's the other way around. And they all discussed it around the room. They said, you're right. And the next thought was, gee, I'm smart. And the thought after that was, they don't have the slightest idea what they're talking about. They don't know. They know as much as they know. They're doing the best that they can. They're doing great work. They saved my life. But they don't know the whole story. So investigating where we think we know. Looking at the body as a shadow. That's where our feelings are. That's where the sensations, what's under the thought, what's under the obsessive thinking. Think about something. I'm thinking today, planning the talk, worrying about the talk. Will they like me? Will I give a new good talk? Will I be able to get in all the quotes? What's under that? Then go under it. Here's this breath. Oh, a little bit anxious in the body about the talk. So the body is a place to go to when we ask, what is this? What do we know? I see this all the time. I'm also a yoga teacher, and people, it takes a long time to feel the bodily experience. Teaching meditation, a lot of you say with these high school kids, asking them, sit down and be aware of your breath. Well, they don't even know what that means. What does it mean to feel a breath? Never had occurred. What does it mean to feel your hand move in yoga? Not looking at your hand and not trying to have your belly be skinnier or your tone and your six-pack abs, but to feel the body in motion. Feel the energy, feel the action. Michael Stone says, if there's no fixed enlightenment, we must keep asking, what is this now? It is the now that is important. It is the what that is secondary. Michael Stone wrote a book called Awake in the World. He's a great yoga and meditation teacher. I'm actually just found another quote in the Inquiring Mind back there, which I hadn't written down. One more quote. And it's actually in a little tiny review that I have in Inquiring Mind. So I'm going to quote me quoting him. Very postmodern. In his new book, this is me that I'm quoting. In his new book of essays on yoga and Buddhism, Michael Stone opens with a tender proposal. Quote, all that is necessary is for your mind and body to be present like the moving grasses, the petals of a tulip, the currents and subcurrents of endless rivers. He also says, when I look for the boundaries of self, I find myself in the midst of nature. So if we don't have a little frozen self that's in a little circle inside here, where are the boundaries of the self? Jung said most of the self with a capital S is outside the body. These deep teachings in Buddhism about what the self, it's not fixed, it's not just here, it's connected. Continuing with Michael Stone, non-attachment means engagement. When we wander in the forest, we also have to take care of the forest. If you wander in your neighborhood, you must also take care of it. The intimacy we find in deep practice motivates us to take action. Practice is action. And yet social revolution without inward transformation will not be successful, as we've seen with many revolutions that have replaced one violent regime with another. So what Claude's talking about, if we come into our peace work with violence, what's the result going to be? So asking, what is this? What is this? What is this? And letting it deepen, letting it expand, letting it connect. The poet Jane Hirschfield. Boiling the whole project, the whole practice, down to 7 words. Because she's a poet, she can do that. So this is great for my quotes. So rather than the elaborate philosophical quotes, here's the whole thing in 7 words. Everything changes. Everything is connected. Pay attention. The second part, everything is connected. Sometimes we miss that if we sit. There can be a little bit of isolation in sitting. This is why we need to come here to groups, sit together. Everything's connected. And let me just throw out one more quote from this Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization by Anilayo, great old school book. That has a certain investigation into it about this, what we think we know. I've felt this before when we talk about movies. Did you like this movie? Did you like that movie? People will come up with an elaborate a list of things if they didn't like the movie, about how they didn't like them, and that's why they didn't like the movie. I suspect it's the other way around, which people describe in Buddhist terms here. That maybe you first don't like the movie. There's an impression. It's like when your first impression meeting a person, and then your mind comes up with the list of reasons to support that you don't like it. Anilayo says sustained contemplation will reveal the fact that feelings decisively influence and color subsequent thoughts and reactions. In view of this conditioning role of feeling, the supposed supremacy of rational thought over feelings and emotions turns out to be an illusion. Logic and thought often serve merely to rationalize already existing likes and dislikes, which in turn are conditioned by the arising of either pleasant or unpleasant feelings. The initial stages of the perceptual process, when the first traces of liking and disliking appear, are not fully conscious, and their decisive influence on subsequent evaluations often passes undetected. I should read that again. It's dense, but the good stuff. Do you see what that's saying there? That a lot of the things we think, they come from something completely other. They come from that first sense of aversion or attraction, pleasant, unpleasant. So this is another way that we sit on the cushion. We're taking apart through practice, taking apart that mental knowing, thinking we know, thinking our view is correct, thinking we're right. Sitting there, breathing in, breathing out. Sound arises, pleasant or unpleasant. how quickly we lose that as soon as we open the mouth and start speaking. And what's it like to start to reel that in? Reel it back in here. When you're in an argument, it's just so funny to watch sometimes an argument between two Buddhists who believe all that, but they're arguing about which Buddhism is right or wrong. What's under that? What is under that? In the body. In the clinging, or in the violence that Claude is talking about. I'll open it up for reflections, comments, questions. We have a microphone that we would like you to use for that. Tell me what you know or don't know. Or recite a poem. Could somebody help me here? I'm all pretzeled up here. We have.
Thanks. My name is John. I really enjoyed your talk. Thank you. Could you talk a little bit more about anger and violence? I'm particularly interested in, I'm working with some adolescents that are in a pretty tough neighborhood in East Oakland. And anger is really a central theme. And I'm just curious, yeah. You know, what are some ways they're expressing their anger, and I'm just curious about how to work with that in a mindful way.
Yeah. Carefully, yeah. As I've said, I've started the group at Laney College. So you have these people that live in these neighborhoods, and Claude, being the expert on this, I'll say one answer. Somebody asked him about this. Well, I mean, come on, we're doing Buddhist practice. You're not condoning anger here. There's a difference. It's the difference between anger and violence. It's the difference. So Claude would say that, like when he told the story here, it's starting to weed out the distinction between the thoughts and the arising phenomena and the action. We try to start with, we don't have to do the action. So we're trying to get a little space in there. And so in this kind of situation, in my experience, really starts with listening, if I'm in that facilitator mode, really listening to them, because I don't want to go in there and roll over their experience with me thinking I know because I'm the well-meaning white boy again. So it's trying to connect with them somehow when somebody comes up at the peace vigil, trying to find where I connect with them, where I connect with them, find something in what they're saying that I can go with, so that I'm not acting, you know, I don't want to be above them or this or that. Finding a way to be with them. I mean, all this wisdom is also there in them, even though, as you know, it may be buried deeply or deeply conditioned. I don't have any answers, but that starting with that I remember deeply from Claude, trying to weed out the difference between the anger stuff here and the violent action and the consequences of the violent action. Thank you for speaking up.
Thanks.
Humor is also another good one. I've seen that with Claude a lot. In you know, he's got the Aikido. This guy has 4 black belts or whatever. And in the tensest of situations, to see him just come up with a one-liner just to defuse the whole thing somehow. Because the Buddha said, somebody said, what is your practice? I practice non-contention with anything or anyone. Zero contention. So to watch somebody that's a master at this, even when somebody is bringing up some heavy material, if you go against it, it's just going to cause problems. So how do we find our way? It's kind of an Aikido move there, to not contend with it, and yet still we're laying out, we're expressing or being or showing another way to go with it. Tricky stuff, good stuff. Well, I'm going to read another quote in that case. You guys are quiet. Joko Beck, another voice. In Zen practice, we tend to toss around many fancy concepts. Everything is perfect in being as it is. We're all doing the best that we can. Things are all one. I am one with him. We can call this Zen bullshit, though other religions have their own versions. It is not that the statements are false. The world is one. I am you. Everything is perfect in being as it is. Every human being is doing the best he or she can at this moment. True enough. But if we stop there, we have turned our practice into an exercise of concepts, and we've lost awareness of what's going on with us right this second. Got to be careful there in those groups if we're working with volatile situations, not to try to impose the concept on there, to find the way in the experience, in the moment. Not easy.
Okay.
Oh.
I have to be louder. Okay. All right. I've been trying to think of how to put feeling into words, and sort of fitting with all the sort of things you've been saying about how we can't put facts into words, you know, decontextualized. But I really appreciate your insistence on bringing up shadow. It started to work. Because I find with the teachings, just the direct teachings about not self and impermanence, they can be scary enough just coming from, you know, sitting peacefully and trying to accept that there's no one here and everything is changing. But then when the shadow, my own shadow, starts to peek out into some light and I can see it when I'm sitting, just what you were just saying about not contending with anything, I find I immediately contract around it. Yeah. And I contend with my own small knowledge of my shadow, because putting that with the truth of impermanence, where's it going to go? How, you know, what else is under there? What else is in there? And so I don't really have a question. It's just sort of an appreciation and also just kind of general frustration that it doesn't get addressed enough, that we all sit and share a connection with each other, and it always involves, at some level, sometimes we all have violent thoughts, and we don't, it's just so squirmy and scary to address together. Yeah. But if we could relax and know that we all have them and it's all true, then maybe it would be a little bit easier to face.
Thank you. Yeah, I just heard a story yesterday of Sharon Salzberg being on the subway platform, I assume New York, and the person next to her turning to her and just saying, I wonder what would happen if I just pushed that person right there onto the tracks. And this, as the story as I heard it, Sharon uses to say that It's like, Claude, these thoughts happen. We all have these thoughts. You're bringing up a good point in there, a little bit of a subtlety, a little bit of a warning. Yeah, it's scary. And these things start to poke their head up. And it's like, how big is this stuff? The tip, because we're seeing the tip of the iceberg. So it is about, you know, we do need to do our practice. We're building with mindfulness. We're building that container, to use the psychological term. We're building that strength to sit with it, to be with it. And the more we do that, the more we can allow and open up more and more to all of our stuff. But it is scary. It does need support. And this is the reason I appreciate teachers like Claude, who are willing to voice that stuff is here in us. Of course, reminds me of another quote. But indeed, the body is the shadow insofar as it contains the tragic history of how spontaneous surging of life energy is murdered and rejected in 100 ways until the body becomes a deadened object. In yoga or in meditation, you start to see how we've numbed out certain areas in the body, that the repressed finds its way, has its effects in the body. That's a quote from John Conger, talking about the danger of getting a little too New Agey, a little bit Puritanism as a strain of our, huge strain in our history. You can see it in the elections right now. I mean, my God, what were these themes that we've lived with for hundreds of years, the way we frame up the world in this pure way. And then to have, so religion has a part in that. So we're countering that voice with the courageous practice of being willing to feel our feelings, which includes speaking out. Just want to bring up one last counter voice, Brad Warner, who's another wild man of Zen. I've met him a couple times. He was a punk rocker, so he was a punker and a bass player in a band, a real band. So Noah's a great punker. But this guy was actually a punk rocker, so he was in the punk band. So he sticks to a certain vocabulary, even a little to this day, even a little more than Noah Levine. And he's a Zen teacher after my own heart. He's one that goes into his groups and swears and does all this stuff, and he just insists on not being the teacher. He says, "I sit here, and you can come and sit with me. That's it. I don't know anything." He likes to take apart a lot of the Zen bullshit. He says, "I believe it's ultimately better to integrate practice into your ordinary life as much as possible. It's better to keep a real job in the real world and to routinely associate with people who don't have the first clue about Zen. People who live full-time in Zen places tend to get a little inbred. For example, they often start using words and phrases that nobody in the outside world and understand without even realizing they're doing so. Kind of the way people are into anything deeply nerdy do. It's better to learn to communicate with the wider community in its own language." So getting not, you know, remembering not to get isolated in our practice with that. True compassion is a spontaneous response to circumstances. It's not situational ethics, doesn't come from thought, it isn't a dream of some utopia that would exist if only this or that or the other condition could be met. It's real action here and now that makes things better. Achan Amaro talks about if your little kid's going to run out in the street, you grab the kid. There's force in that. It's not all groovy New Agey. What needs to be done is sometimes has strong action to it. And I think that's it for the evening of quotes. Let me say, J. Jane Hirschfield's poem one more time, and then we will sit a little, do a little bit of metta. Everything changes. Everything is connected. Pay attention. So we'll do a few minutes of metta to close up. So get in a comfy position for this one. And I'll do the one you maybe have done it before that includes a little bit of image and feel to it. Let the body sit comfortably, mindfully present. And feel your way into, imagine your way into a place, a warm pool of water. Maybe it looks like Hawaii or wherever is perfect for you. Feel it. Feel the water on your skin. And what we're doing is cultivating. So it's a cultivation practice. Also can be a purification. So if the opposite arises, that's fine too. Just working with this stuff. Leaning the heart toward this. Sitting in a nice body of water. The landscape and the sky are beautiful and perfect. It's safe in this water. And just feeling how it's safe and pleasant. And have a sense of well-being. In fact, let that generate around your heart. The traditional phrases, may I be peaceful, may I be safe, may I be happy. You don't have to repeat those, but having that sense, it's okay sitting right here. And invite a dear one to sit right across from you in the pond or the hot tub or whatever it is. Feel them sit and plop down into the water and look at them and see in their eyes their care for you and your care for them. Breathe it. Wish them well. Wow, may you be happy. May you be free from suffering. Relax into it. Feel the support. And in fact, it's so nice that you can invite a couple others, family, dear ones, to sit here with you together in this sense of kindness, freedom. May we be peaceful, may we be happy. In fact, these waters that we're sitting in, that are soothing and safe, are the waters of kindness, the waters of compassion. The water is big enough to allow some more folks in. People in this room. People in your life, traditionally called neutral. Somebody you just, you don't feel so much one way or the other. You see them at, they work at the shop or somewhere. Wow, they're human. Take a load off. Let them sit down in the pool. May you too be free from suffering. And the waters expand, and there, it's even big enough in this pool for people, a person or people you've had problems with. They're human beings. They were born of a mother. Let them enter. Let them deserve peace. and the waters extend across this area, across this continent, connecting all over the planet, where there is a lot of suffering going on now. Can we stay in this, rest in this kindness and compassion, and stay connected in that world? Breathing, connected, paying attention, feeling the kindness circulating around through yourself and the world, and letting now the images dissolve. Here we are, just this. May all beings everywhere be free from suffering. May all beings be peaceful and happy. Thank you very much for coming out. It's been a pleasure to sit with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.